Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inch, and we're glad to have you listening. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about America's most sophisticated and secretive intelligence organization, the National Security Agency. And our guest for the program is investigative journalist James Bamford. He's authored a book on the NSA that's just come out. The title is Body of Secrets, The Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency. The book is published by Doubleday. It is, in fact, the second book that he's written on the NSA. The first was published back in 1982. That book was titled The Puzzle Palace. It sold rather widely, got a lot of attention. So he now is the author of basically the only two books, the thorough book-length treatments of the NSA that exist. He has been an investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight. He's also written for a number of publications on investigative topics, including cover stories for the New York Times Magazine on the Iran-Contra affair, the Washington Post Magazine on the Korean Airlines shootdown, and also the Los Angeles Times Magazine on the Mafia. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk with James Bamford, your questions are welcome. We ask only that people just try to be brief, and that will help us include as many callers as possible and keep the show moving along. Anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere that signal will travel, use the toll-free line, and the call will be on us. And that is, again, 800-222-9455. So the numbers are slightly different. Locally, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Bamford, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks.
We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The United States has several major intelligence gathering entities, the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA and the NSA. Specifically on the NSA, what is its mission, and does its mission differ from these other agencies?
Well, the NSA is actually the largest intelligence agency in the world, and it's about double the size of the CIA. The CIA's responsibility is to send human agents in foreign countries to steal secrets, the old James Bond spy versus spy type of espionage. And the CIA is also responsible for developing the final intelligence estimates and so forth, final intelligence reports. NSA, on the other hand, is responsible for eavesdropping on communications all over the world, some of which are encrypted, and those NSA is responsible for breaking the codes, breaking the cipher systems, and reading the communications. And it's also responsible for developing America's encryption systems. So that's pretty much the difference. And most of the intelligence that the world, that the United States gets, comes from NSA. It doesn't come really from the spies of the CIA. They contribute some, but most of the information comes from NSA's eavesdropping satellites and eavesdropping listening posts and so forth.
How did the NSA get started?
Well, actually, the founding of the NSA is very unique. The CIA, for example, was formed in the late 40s by a public law. There were hearings in Congress, and there was nothing secret about the creation of the CIA. NSA, on the other hand, was created in absolute secrecy. It was created by a 7-page memorandum put out by President Truman in 1952. So he created the NSA in 1952 with a top-secret 7-page memorandum that was secret up until just a few years ago.
You've been to the NSA's headquarters?
Yes, I've been through there a number of times.
What's it like?
Well, it's an entire city. I call it Crypto City in the book. It's a very large city, about 50 or 60 buildings. They've got their own chip manufacturing factory. They have their own police force. They even have their own fairly unique film festival once a year with films and their native languages, from Icelandic to Karen, which is spoken in the Burmese Thai border, and a lot of other very unique languages. So it's a very unique place. In addition, they have the world's largest collection of supercomputers there. They have the perhaps the world's largest collection of mathematicians and language experts. So it's a very unique place, and it's hidden from the public by fences and all kinds of barriers and so forth.
Hmm. What I understand is when you wrote The Puzzle Palace, certainly the NSA was not real thrilled about this and was not interested in providing much in the way of assistance. But things changed when, at least some shortly after you started working on the new book, Body of Secrets, and it seems as if the NSA is interested in some greater degree of openness, and the concern there is that they would like people to know a little bit more about what they do, and then perhaps if there's a little bit more awareness of the agency and its significance, then there will continue to be support and funding for the agency.
That's right, David. Actually, when I did the Puzzle Palace, even though I was just a journalist, I never worked for NSA, they tried twice to have me prosecuted for writing the book, the very first book on NSA. That was during the early Reagan administration period. After that, there's a new book, which I just started about 3 years ago. It took about 3 years to write. The attitude was pretty much the same. It was very somewhat hostile, and there was offered no help or anything. But then about halfway through the book, a new director came on board, Lieutenant General Michael Hayden, and he had basically a change of attitude, and he agreed to open the door a crack for me and let me come in and gave me a number of tours and interviews with the director and a number of other officials, and I was able to obtain a fair amount of documents from NSA. So it changed quite a bit, and there were a couple reasons. One of them was during the Reagan years, the money flowed like Niagara Falls in NSA. The money just poured in there, and they didn't really need any public support or anything. Today it's much different. NSA has to compete for dollars with the CIA and the DIA and basically the entire national security budget, the military and other parts of it. So NSA has become more publicity conscious, more or less. At the same time, Hollywood was sort of defining what NSA was for the public through a variety of movies that were highly inaccurate. A number of the movies portrayed NSA officials as assassins and so forth. So I think they saw the prospect of my new book as an opportunity to at least set the record straight that NSA doesn't employ assassins, and that NSA does do a number of positive things for the country, and you know, deserves the money that it gets, and even more money, because right now it's asking Congress for much larger budgets than Congress in the past has been willing to give it. So I think that's the reason for the shift in attitude, and the shift has been very dramatic. Instead of trying to put me in jail like they did the last time, this time they actually invited me to NSA to lecture to their most senior cryptologic class and had a actual book signing for me at the agency afterwards. So it's a dramatic difference.
Well, not to be too flippant, but it's interesting that one of my coworkers, when he heard I was doing this show, came in and talked to me this morning. He explained to me that his sister was in the Navy, and she had been at NSA for some kind of conference and brought back T-shirts and coffee mugs, and he was bemused with the idea that the most secret intelligence gathering agency in the world should have a gift shop.
Well, that's right. It was when I was at ABC News, as a matter of fact, I did, it was the only humorous story I ever did when I was at ABC, and it was a Christmas story. It was, I worked for World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. And we did a Christmas story about the gift shops of the different intelligence agencies. And the CIA, the very secret National Reconnaissance Office, and NSA, they all have their own gift shops now with T-shirts and mugs and baseball caps and everything else. So it's having watched this transition for the last 20 years, it is very, very amazing.
Our guest this morning is James Bamford. He's the author of Body of Secrets. It's a newly published book that looks at the history, structure, function of the National Security Agency. The book's published by Doubleday. It is, in fact, his second book on the NSA. The first was published in 1982. The title of that book, The Puzzle Palace. He's worked as an investigative producer for ABC News and has also written for publications including The New York Times Magazine, The Washington Post Magazine, and LA Times Magazine. And your questions are welcome. We have somebody here ready to go. Others are certainly welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Here's someone in Mahomet to talk with on our line one. Hello.
Hi, thank you much. One of the types of signals that the NSA likes to collect is telephone conversations, but it's illegal for our government to eavesdrop on our own citizens. And I understand there's a similar law in Great Britain. And I've read that we actually trade information. We listen in on Great Britain's citizens and their intelligence service listen in on our citizens, and then we trade the information, or at least we tell them what's interesting that we found, and likewise. Have you heard anything about this, and can you comment on that?
Yes. During the early part of NSA's history, from 1952 until 1975, NSA was involved in massive illegal eavesdropping on U.S. citizens, both telegrams and telephone calls. That was exposed in 1975, and a number of laws were created after that, in addition to both the Senate and House Intelligence Committee. So since 1975, the NSA has been regulated in terms of domestic spying by these laws. The laws forbid NSA to eavesdrop on most U.S. citizens. However, exceptions are made in cases of persons suspected of espionage or terrorism. And in order to eavesdrop on those people, NSA actually has to go to a secret court. It's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which almost no lawyers have ever heard of. It's a secret court in Washington, and they go there and they ask for permission to eavesdrop on U.S. citizens. It's good in the fact that now they have to go to this court and get this this warrant in order to do it. What's somewhat troubling is the fact that since the court was founded back in around 1978, the court has never once turned down the government on a request. And even if the government was turned down on a request by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the government has a right to appeal to another court known as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Appeals Court, which has the unique distinction of being the only court in the United States never to have ever heard a case. So that's the situation the way it is today. Now, one of the potential loopholes is for NSA to ask the British to spy on people that it can't legally spy on, and vice versa. However, if you read the law closely, that's not really an exception. NSA. That would also be a violation of the law if they asked the British to do what's illegal for the NSA to do. In doing two books on NSA, I haven't really found any evidence that NSA is currently engaged in massive domestic eavesdropping. I mean, it may happen, but most of what NSA's targets are overseas and not U.S. The FBI, on the other hand, is the agency that's mostly responsible for eavesdropping on U.S. citizens. Although NSA does have a very checkered past in terms of illegal spying on U.S. citizens, there are a number of checks and balances that exist today that didn't exist in the past. And to a large degree, I think NSA is pretty much complying with that.
Interesting. So you've not run across any evidence in the past, let's say since 1975, that we have in fact traded with the British.
Not on U.S. citizens. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of trading with the British on lots of information, not only the British, but...
Oh, sure, I understand that, but I mean, I'm talking about the citizens.
No, I haven't, you know, I've looked, and obviously that would be on the first page of my book if I had found it, and but again, I'm an outsider looking in, so
sure.
I, you know, I don't have anything in there on it because I haven't found any evidence of it. I mean, one of NSA's problems is not, they're not really that interested in American citizens. And again, that's sort of the FBI's job. And NSA's problem today is that it can't even eavesdrop on the things it's supposed to eavesdrop on, let alone sort of superfluous things. I mean, it totally missed the nuclear test in India, for example, which was an enormous embarrassment because everybody kind of expected that it was going to take place, and NSA totally missed it.
Wow.
It missed the bombings in East Africa, in Tanzania and Kenya. It missed the, gave no warning about the bombing of the USS Cole in the Persian Gulf. So that's what NSA gets in trouble for, is missing these big things. And so it's having a hard time doing what it's supposed to do, let alone, you know, eavesdropping on average U.S. citizens. So,
hey, David, do I have time for a second question?
Well, I've got several other people, and if it's okay.
That's fine.
I appreciate your being patient, and because I do want to get on some other folks. And actually, though, maybe with their indulgence for a minute here, I think I should ask you to talk about Echelon.
Yeah.
Because it has gotten some attention in the press recently, and I guess my understanding was, or the concern that people had was that this cooperative effort involving the Britain and the United States was still going on, and we were eavesdropping on people all over the world, and there was some concern, I think, that this was extending into communications that were going on over the Internet.
Well, that's true. NSA doesn't exist alone in the world in terms of eavesdropping. After World War II, the major English-speaking countries of the world, the United States, Great Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, got together and signed an agreement, a very, very secret agreement called the UK-USA Agreement, otherwise known as the Yakuza Agreement. And what that agreement did was basically divide up the world in terms of spheres of interest for each of the countries in terms of eavesdropping. So Britain, for example, could easily eavesdrop on much of Europe and Western Russia, for example. The U.S. could eavesdrop on other parts of Eastern Europe and the Far East, and Australia could eavesdrop on Southeast Asia. So there was a division of the world in terms of eavesdropping. Echelon is the name of the system used for sharing all that information. So we may want to get some new information on what the Chinese are doing in the Paracel Islands or something like that. And Australia might be able to get that information. So Australia would eavesdrop on it, intercept the communications, and then pass it on to NSA. And likewise, what Australia or New Zealand or Canada or Britain might want, the U.S. might pick up and give to them. Again, as I mentioned before, none of that is supposed to involve U.S. citizens. So that's what the sharing arrangement is, and excuse me, that's basically what Echelon is. It's a worldwide sharing information among these countries of intercepted information. The major concern today is among the European community. They're very afraid that NSA is eavesdropping on their businesses, their commercial interests in their countries, and then passing that information on to U.S. corporations, economic intelligence. So, in other words, eavesdropping on the French company Airbus and then passing that information on to the American company Boeing. I've never found any evidence that NSA is involved in that type of economic eavesdropping. NSA does, however, eavesdrop on foreign companies in Europe. It does that fairly regularly. The main thing it's looking for is the shipment of suspect or embargoed goods, such as dangerous chemicals from a company in France to the government of Libya, for example, or embargoed nuclear parts going to Iraq. And that's pretty much what they're interested in. In the course of doing that, NSA occasionally comes across evidence of some foreign companies bribing, giving out bribes in order to get contracts, and in those cases, NSA sends a protest to the government of whatever country that is that's involved. So that's pretty much what Echelon is and what the controversy is over Echelon at this point.
We have we're almost at the midpoint already. We have our lines full, so I want to get right back to callers. And next in line is Savoy, line number two. Hello.
What is the relationship of the president's national security advisor to the agency?
The president's national security advisor basically does just that, advise the president on national security issues, and to a large degree acts as a coordinator of intelligence information going to the president. And in that sense, Condoleezza Rice, who's the national security advisor, coordinates information coming from NSA to the president. And Condoleezza Rice may call up the director of NSA and say that the president has become concerned about new development of in North Korea of the their three-stage missile, and he'd like to get more information on that. And then NSA, in turn, would start directing more of his attention towards North Korea. I mean, that's sort of how it would work.
The director is a more permanent position?
I'm sorry?
Is the director a more permanent position?
Director of NSA?
Yes.
Yes. Well, it's not a permanent position. It's a rotating position.
Relatively.
It's a military officer. It's always a three-star, either admiral or general, and they usually stay for 3 years, although I think the current director may be extended for 5 years.
Okay.
And then it's a lot of times it's rotated among the Army, Navy, and Air Force.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Chicago next, line four. Hello.
Good morning. Yes. I wanted to know, is it true that the NSA is having trouble reading some of the new calls and software because it is very easy now to download encryption software from the Internet, so that is giving them a lot of problems?
Yes, that's one of the big issues now. The issue is whether NSA is going deaf because of all the new technologies. I mean, just to give you an idea, and the flood of information, 20 years ago when I did the Puzzle Palace, most of the information, and I wrote that book on a typewriter, by the way, and most of the information that was transmitted among people or among companies or even governments went through the mail in envelopes, sealed in envelopes, which obviously was not accessible to NSA. They were limited to high-frequency communications and telephone communications and so forth. But today, the flood of information that's available to NSA is just enormous. People don't send things in envelopes anymore. They send them as email attachments, or they send them through the Internet one way or another, even personal letters and so forth. So in addition to all the documents and information that's sent through the Internet, there's a tremendous amount of new communications going through the air as a result of cell phones, for example, and faxes and so forth. So NSA's problem now really isn't so much picking up information. It's sifting through all the information that's available to it. And that's one of the problems now, is that NSA's having a lot of trouble sifting through all the information in the Internet and all the information going through the air. At the same time, it's faced with two other problems. One of those is the shift from satellite communications, which are very easy to intercept. All you need is a dish out there, and it collects it like rain, to the shift to buried fiber optic cables, which are far more difficult to eavesdrop on. NSA can do it, but it's much more difficult.
The other
switch is to encryption. There's much more encryption today. And
I'll say you can download encryption software right off the net now, and that might be giving you problems as well.
Exactly. It hasn't reached really the crisis stage for NSA because encryption's still somewhat immature in terms of use throughout the world.
It'll get better.
But that's what NSA sees down the road is a real problem with encryption throughout the world.
Thank you.
All right. Next caller is in Champaign County. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. I have more than a couple of things, but I guess I'll just try and focus on. I was wondering if you might retell the anecdote from Puzzle Palace that connects to the Urbana-Champaign campus. I think the biggest, most notorious defection in the McCarthy era was by two Russian, American-Russian scholars here. More on the up-to-date contemporary scene, it seems that with SDI, whatever they're calling it now, nuclear missile defense, looking at boost phase and forward deployed ships, that if they're not going to wait until detection in space, that they're going to actually be watching more closely, you know, ground activity than they are already. And I'm wondering whether NSA is it the usual jockeying for position amongst the agencies, and et cetera? And have you looked at that? I noticed that you've written something for the Bulletin Atomic Scientists recently about a new book on spy satellites, which I guess is might be connected in some ways. But if you could talk about those.
Sure.
I mean, the first case is like pretty notorious, but I mean, it's sort of been obscured by things like Hansen and contemporary situation.
Thanks. Yeah, good questions. The first question had to do with a actually it was the largest it was really the first really major spy case in NSA's history and probably its biggest. What happened were two NSA analysts in 1960 decided to defect to the Soviet Union, and actually they told their bosses they were going on vacation, and instead of going on vacation, they went to Cuba and then were secretly transported out of Cuba to Moscow, and they actually held a press conference in Moscow. So it was an enormous embarrassment, and that was the first thing ever to bring NSA sort of to light to the public. One of the interesting connections with the Champaign-Urbana campus there is the one of the NSA analysts had actually taken some courses, had actually taken a course in Russian at the school there. And NSA sent a lot of people to schools to become Russian linguists, and they sent one of these two defectors to the school to learn Russian, and that was one of the things I think that one of the things that caused them to be to go to Russia in the first place actually was they learned Russian and then began reading up on Russian life, and they seemed to like what they read, what they read, and they defected. On the second question, it was on NSA sort of competition with the other intelligence agencies as the intelligence as NSA starts moving to eavesdrop on coastal areas and so forth. A lot of this came up during the recent crisis over the plane that went down in China. That plane was basically working for NSA. All signals intelligence operations, which is what that plane was doing, comes under NSA. The major question that's come up with regard to that is whether those flights are useless or not, because you don't really need to send those flights out there every single day, back and forth, these slow four-engine prop planes collecting that kind of intelligence. That was sort of the way we did it in the middle of the Cold War against Russia, when they had submarines off our coast. And what the U.S. has done now is, although it hasn't gotten a lot of publicity, they have pretty much not gone back to that form of intelligence collection, and instead they're using these much more sophisticated planes known as RC-135 rivet joint aircraft, which are basically military versions of the Boeing 707. And these are basically flying vacuum cleaners, and they just fly along the a coast. All they need to do is do it once, and they suck up everything, every signal there is practically. So it's a much more efficient and much less provocative way of doing it. And I think that's the way they may start doing it more often now. Anyway, I hope that answers your question.
Okay, and let's go on to the next caller. That would be in Champaign, line number one. Hello?
Yes, thank you. Well, first, I thought in regards to the China incident that the actual purpose of that mission was, in fact, to trip the radar and you know, see what the response the Chinese would have to any sort of intrusion, rather than more, you know, gathering more generic intelligence about what's going on. But in fact, it was more of a provocation to see, you know, what their systems, how they operated. But, you know, I say I read your book, The Puzzle Palace, with great interest, and I thought there, as I recall, maybe memory may not serve, but there were other references to also to U of I about as a recruiting ground and the research and things like that. And I wonder if you could illuminate any current connections between the NSA and the University of Illinois.
Just to get back to the beginning of your question there, the flights were not really designed to be provocative in the sense that they were during World War, or rather during the Cold War. Those flights during the Cold War actually did penetrate Chinese and Russian airspace, and that triggered the turning on of the electronics. These flights were 50 miles off the coast, so they weren't, and they never made any intention of penetrating the territory. Nevertheless, they were provocative, and to some degree, the Chinese may have turned on some communications they might not have normally turned on. But we're not in the same situation we were with Russia. The Chinese had like 20 missiles. The Russians had tens of thousands. So we're not really in the same position. And to have the same type of espionage we did in the height of the Cold War, I don't think is very useful. And I think they could collect just as much with these RC-135s and the ground stations and the satellites and so forth. On the second part, I can't recall actually from the Puzzle Palace the other references to the campus there. But if you want to refresh my memory, I've just spent so much time in this new book trying to recall what I wrote about it in the old book 20 years ago. It's just kind of tough. But if you could.
Well, it's been probably 15 years since I read it myself. I recalled. Some discussion of recruitment here, and also being a major computer research university, wouldn't surprise me if there were contracts to develop equipment and things, or methods and things like that, software, other things that the NSA would be using.
Yeah, well, the NSA does a lot of campus recruiting, and I'm sure they do a fair amount of it at the campus. It's a huge area for potential recruits, and I would think it's one of the key areas that they do a lot of recruiting at. I know even more now than in the past, they're looking for people who are expert in computer science and that type of thing. So I'm sure there's recruiters that have been there probably within the last year, I would think.
Well, thank you.
All right, let's go to line number two. This is Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, you kept me up last night, Mr. Bamford. I thought I'd check to see what was written about your book, and it was so interesting. I didn't get
till
late. But so I could ask a dozen questions, but I think I'll just ask a couple. One is... it must be a heck of a book. One is having to do with the 1967 Israeli attack on the American ship Liberty. I was wondering, I read one account that said that kind of poo-pooed your take on that incident because it says it thought that your proof of this slaughter I don't know who
it was. It was Egyptians.
Oh, Egyptians, right, yeah. Egyptians by the Israelis, and they're trying to cover it up by attacking the ship, the Liberty ship.
Right.
Was based on really slim data. And I was just wondering, how would you still... you've been pretty harsh on Israel in general, and I don't doubt you're in general correct. But in this particular instance, I was wondering if you still defended your account of the...
Well, of course they do. The evidence is not slim at all. If anybody wants to look at the footnotes, they're right there. The footnotes actually come from articles that were in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the AP and a number of other sources. And those newspaper articles quoted the actual military historians in Israel as having written these reports about the atrocities that took place. There's no question that they took place. And there's no question they took place at the time the U.S.'s liberty was off the coast. How many it took place, you know, it's in the hundreds, whether it's 300, 400, or whatever. The point was that there were prisoners who had their hands tied behind their backs that were murdered, slaughtered, killed, whatever you want to say, by the Israelis on the Sinai Desert at the time the U.S.'s liberty was off the coast. The reason this issue comes up is because the USS Liberty was an intelligence collection ship working on behalf of NSA. NSA wanted to know what was happening during the Six-Day War in 1967 and sent the ship in international waters off of off the Sinai. And one of the things that the ship did was eavesdrop on a lot of the communications on the shoreline. It was only 13 miles away. During one of the passes during one of its passes back and forth across the Sinai area, when it was in international waters, again about 13 miles out at sea, in broad daylight, about 2 in the afternoon, the ship was attacked by Israeli aircraft, Israeli fighters. They attacked it mercilessly. They fired over 800 rounds of cannon fire into the ship. They fired rockets into the ship. They dropped bombs on the ship. Then they leveled napalm all over the ship, burning napalm. When they had expended all of their weapons, they left, and then three Israeli torpedo boats came up, and they fired virtually all their torpedoes. Five torpedoes were fired at the USS Liberty, which was an old World War II cargo ship, fitted out with a lot of antennas. That would have been enough to sink several aircraft carriers.
It's amazing that more people didn't die.
Well, they missed with four of the torpedoes. One of the torpedoes actually hit right in the NSA intercept spaces, killing 25 U.S. sailors immediately. By the time it was all over, there were 34 Americans dead. The executive officer had been killed. The commanding officer, Captain McGonagall, had been wounded. The ship was burning and had a hole the size of a size big enough to drive a bus into, and it managed to make it back to safety. The captain was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. The question was why Israel did it. There's no question that Israel did it. The question was why. That was a question that nobody ever took the time to ask. The United States never conducted an investigation as to why that took place. Unlike with the USS Cole, where the FBI agents were flown into Yemen to conduct an investigation, unlike the attack on the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, where the FBI was flown in to investigate, nobody ever did an investigation, not Congress, not the FBI, not the administration, nobody ever did an investigation then or now of what happened during that incident. And you get a lot of people who are, you know, extremely pro-Israel, and they get offended any time you bring the subject up. And you have to put up with that because they can't accept the fact that this took place. It did take place. Israel's explanation for it made no sense at all. They thought their explanation was that they thought the ship was going 30 knots. The ship was going between 3 and 5 knots, and its total speed was 17 knots. They said they saw no American flag on the ship. Well, the flag was flying on the ship before, during, and after the attack. And once the Israelis at one point shot it down, they put up an even bigger flag, and that's been testified to by virtually every member of the crew.
I'm grateful that you are pursuing it. Can I ask you one quick other question, though?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
When you were talking about the how it's only the FBI that can spy on Americans, and I know one of the things that the NSA one of the keywords they get in on is drugs, having anything to do about drugs. Now,
yes,
You know, I wish the FBI was able to, instead of, I wish the United States, instead of pursuing this drug war in Colombia and stuff, I guess it would be the lesser of two evils if the FBI could listen in on Americans and track down drug traffic here and, you know, stop the demand. But my question is, you said the FBI can do that, but the NSA can't. But does the FBI have access to free access to the NSA's equipment and capabilities and such?
Well, actually, yeah, that's a good question because that is the sort of area that's the most troubling in terms of domestic spying. If NSA is trying to eavesdrop on Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, I mean, there's no problem with that. The tricky areas is when NSA begins eavesdropping on Colombia drug dealers in Colombia who are speaking on the phone to Americans in the United States. You know, is that does that get into domestic eavesdropping or not? And that's the sort of gray area that NSA is involved in that is, you know, it gets tricky as to whether that's domestic eavesdropping or not. In terms of drug dealing, NSA is heavily involved in that whole area, and the FBI does have access to NSA information dealing with international drug dealing that NSA picks up. NSA is very worried about any of their information ever getting into court, and that's one of the things that NSA that concerns NSA about sharing its information with, say, the FBI or the DEA, because if in open court a defense attorney is able to ask an NSA official, you know, how did you pick this up, where did you pick it up, what method did you use to eavesdrop on those communications, that gets into areas that NSA doesn't like to talk about. So it's a very touchy area, and it's a very difficult area. It's one that NSA and the FBI and the DEA and these other areas, these other agencies, have a lot of very intense discussions about.
Just have about 5 minutes left. We have another caller here, Belgium. That's next, line four. Hello.
Hello. Yes, to make it brief, I used to live near NSA. I have relatives who work there. And when you say they're secret, you have no idea how secret those people are. The people who work there will not even tell you that they work there. As I remember, at the time when I lived there, there was not even a sign in front of the place. So you couldn't even know where it was at. You had some extremely secret people. And so how do you know that they're not actually listening to us at this very moment?
Well, that's a good question. Like I said, I'm an outsider looking in, and I just do the best I can. So I can't give anybody any kind of guarantees.
Yeah.
All I can say is that in interviewing people that have worked there, that worked there in the past, and people who have told me other things about what NSA does, and they're the ones who have told me that they don't
talk
anymore. So I just have to take their word for it. But you know, all I am is an outsider looking in.
Exactly.
And like you said, it is an extremely secret place, and that's the way most of the people around that area feel, I think.
Oh, yes. If you talk to anybody, like this one relative of mine who has since retired, she still refuses to even speak of things that are so far gone from being important that they do not speak about anything, period.
Well, that hasn't changed much, so.
No.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. I'm sorry to say we're getting very close to the end. I'm sure we could go another hour if we had the opportunity. Maybe, though, here real quick, I would ask a question. Maybe you can talk for a couple of minutes about oversight. Just what kind of oversight is there of the activities of the NSA? Who does the NSA have to answer to?
Well, the basic oversight comes from the Senate and House Intelligence Committees. The problem is that they're small committees. The staff is probably less than 100 of the combined between the two, and the committee members have an awful lot of other committees that they deal with. So you're talking about an agency that's about 38,000 people, and that's just one agency in the entire intelligence community. So although the House and Senate have as their principal mandate the oversight of NSA and the other intelligence agencies, it's a very difficult topic to oversee because they're so small and the agencies are so big, and the agencies pride themselves on keeping things secret. So there's an occasional battle between the intelligence committees and the intelligence agencies, particularly NSA, over whether they could release information to them or not.
Hmm. There are many, many interesting stories in the book. Maybe here again, I get you to talk for a little bit about this. This boggles my mind, this plan that the Joint Chiefs came up with in the 60s when they were interested in constructing some justification for invasion of Cuba. They actually signed off on, they all agreed to a plan that looked to me like that we're actually talking about domestic foreign and domestic terrorism, which would be blamed on Cuba as a way of justifying us going to war against Cuba.
That's right. It was a really incredible thing that when I found it. It actually has nothing to do with NSA.
Mm-hmm.
I want to clear NSA from that. But I found it while I was working on the book on NSA. And what it is a operation devised by the Joint Chiefs of Staff that was to get the American public really angry at Cuba, angry enough to allow the Joint Chiefs to launch their overt war against Cuba, their Army, Navy, and Air Force going in to take over Cuba. So in order to get the American public angry enough to allow the military to go in and take over Cuba, the Joint Chiefs came up with these ideas that they actually approved, which were absolutely bizarre. One of them was creating terrorism in the United States. The Joint Chiefs were going to have people, perhaps soldiers or somebody working for them, shoot people on the streets and explode bombs and blame it all on Cuba, plant false evidence, blaming it on Cuba. They were going to sink refugee boats on the high seas. They had even one plan to encase John Glenn when he was going up on his very first mission into outer space, the very first American into space. If his rocket accidentally blew up, the Joint Chiefs were going to had a plan that they were going to blame Cuba. They were going to show that Cuba was the actual responsible party behind the sabotage.
Mm.
And again, all this was to turn the American public against Cuba to the extent that we would declare war on Cuba. So luckily, once the plan got up to Secretary of Defense McNamara, it never went any further, and I assume he turned it down because I never saw any further mention of it after the meeting with McNamara. But the fact that the senior military officers, the chairman and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, could actually have approved a plan like that is very frightening.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have to stop. There is certainly much, as our guest said, that didn't directly involve the NSA, but there's much more about the NSA, its activities in the Cold War, in Vietnam, elsewhere in the book we've mentioned. So if you're interested, you can look for it. It's titled Body of Secrets, published by Doubleday by James Bamford. And Mr. Bamford, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks, David. I appreciate the questions. They're all very good.